Friday and a lively day on the radio. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
World champion Amy Broadhurst, good morning.
Good morning, how are you?
Oh, I'm well, but how are you? Congratulations.
Oh, thanks very much. Even just hearing that there, it's madness. It's crazy.
If you look at the early Star Trek, when they wanted to talk to each other, they took this thing out of their pocket, flipped it open and started talking. What does that sound like? You know, it wasn't until the 1970s that the world's first mobile phone was invented. So in 1966, this is completely futuristic.
Rashers was retired to a local pet farm, lived there happily until he died. And he didn't become Rashers. That's a very important thing to say. He never became Rashers.
And we'll start with Morning Ireland and two victorious female boxers and an extremely proud dad on the line from Istanbul.
And they beam from the front pages of our morning newspapers, gold medals in hand. Two young women who pulled off a sensational boxing double at the World Championships in Turkey last evening. In just 30 minutes, first Amy Broadhurst, the 25-year-old Dundalk woman, unanimously won her light welterweight bout. She was followed by 20-year-old Roscommon native Lisa O'Rourke, boxing her way to a 4-1 victory over her Mozambique rival. Amy's dad, Tony Broadhurst, is in Istanbul and he's on the line. Tony, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Gosh, what an evening in Istanbul. First Amy, then Lisa. You must be so thrilled, so proud.
It's very difficult to put into words. It's all emotions. It was absolutely fantastic. It was a dream that became reality, and where could you write it? You've not only got Amy in the World Championship final, but Lisa O'Rourke also, and for Ireland to have two world champions on the same day in the same tournament has never been achieved before.
She was in the ring against an Algerian opponent, an opponent that I read has some height and reach advantages over her. Did you have any doubts during the course of the bout?
Well, when I've probably been to all Amy's tournaments from she was a little girl, and we came to this tournament, and I knew and I really believed that this tournament, everything had come together for her in her preparation, her mindset, and each opponent was approached in a different way, and it was like one fight at a time. So we came over here, and the guy says to Amy, I says, listen, we're not to think about wanting to be world champion, wanting to get a world medal. We get the draw, we focus on your first fight and your first fight only. And you take it like that. But definitely when Amy made the final, I knew the Algerian very well. So, you know, it's always a big help when you know your opponent's style. You're quite sure of what they're going to bring into the ring. You know, their dangers and their weaknesses. So, yeah, if you look at Amy's opponent, you think, oh, you know, but we knew Amy was well capable of doing a good job, which she did.
Tony, we had Amy on the programme just as she was heading off to Istanbul for the World Championships. She was just back from sparring with Katie Taylor prior to her Vegas professional competition. Taylor, of course, has talked about her being the future of boxing with all the skills in the world, the heart and the grit. And I know the head coach, Zerrin Antia, has talked about her control and her resilience. But you know all this. Where does your girl get that?
That's funny because 10 minutes ago I was saying, oh, she gets her body from me, and my wife is, she gets her strong mentality from me. Oh, just messing about. I don't know. My three boys, they're all older than Amy. They all won Irish titles and European medals also. But they didn't love boxing the way Amy did. They done it because it was successful. So they represented Ireland on numerous occasions, but they weren't in love with it. Amy fell in love with boxing at 5 years old, and it's for 20 years. It's all she lives and breathes is boxing. She, you know, like, I've been coaching over 20 years now, and not because she's my own daughter, but I've never seen anybody to give up their life the way she does. It's so obsessive in wanting to win, wanting to achieve and loving it.
Tony Broadhurst, then that gold medal win was beginning to sink in for Amy.
World champion Amy Broadhurst, good morning.
Good morning, how are you?
Oh, I'm well, but how are you? Congratulations.
Oh, thanks very much. Even just hearing that there, it's madness. It's crazy.
You're living the dream.
I am, but it's took a long road to get here. It's been 20 years of my life that's actually got me here. Like, I've had European medals and that before, but all I've wanted was a world medal and to go and get a world gold. It's just unbelievable. I don't think it's sunk in yet. I don't think it'll sink in until I'm at home on my own and I'm actually just thinking of what I've just achieved.
We had your dad Tony on a little while ago. Obviously, he is
he loves
bursting, bursting with pride. Amy, he said, and you've just said it there, since you were 5 years old, your focus has been boxing. What is it? What is the love?
I honestly couldn't tell you. I just knew from a little girl that this is what I wanted to do. And even yesterday, before I came out for my fight, I just thought to myself, like, 20 years ago, I started boxing and this is what I've been dreaming about from I was that age.
Let me bring you on to yesterday's bout against your Algerian opponent. Were you nervous going into the ring, or did you think you had the measure of her?
I didn't think I had the measure of her. I never once got into the ring thinking that was going to be an easy fight. The first round was very, very close, I thought. I couldn't have called it. And the scoring was right. It was 3-2. But you know what? Even though it was so close in the first round, I enjoyed every second of it. And as the fight went on, then I just grew into the fight and became more comfortable. In fairness, the tactics that the coaches had for me were spot on. They worked perfectly, so they did.
Your head coach says that you listen, you take instruction, that you have tremendous control, you have enormous resilience.
Sometimes I think the day before against India, I wasn't really switched on, and to be honest, I probably didn't listen too much. And I don't know why, but I knew yesterday that couldn't be the case if I wanted to win. So yesterday I was fully switched on and I listened to everything that was said to me.
Most of us will never know what it is like to stand there with a gold medal to represent your country and to win that. I mean, it must be an incredible feeling.
It's amazing. And even, like, my phone has been hopping, but I've seen the support I've been getting, especially from Dundalk as well. It's like the whole town has seen me over the years just push and push and push for these sort of results. And the fact that I'm returning back to Dundalk as a world champion is just, it doesn't really feel real at the moment. It's madness.
And you'll be heading home tomorrow?
Tomorrow, yeah. We get home, I think, about 4 o'clock, Dublin Airport. So I'll be looking forward to seeing my own bed. It's been long enough, 4.5 weeks. We've been away a very long time, but like it's been worth it. And I've enjoyed every second of it.
What you've just been through, winning a gold medal, that's a harder forum than the Olympics. And I know your ambition is to go to the next Olympics and the one after that. So you're set fair for it now, aren't you?
I am. I've put my name up there. I've always had people telling me, oh, like, you're one of the best in the world. But it actually took myself to believe it, to go and do it, if that makes sense. I have people around me who have seen just how good I am, but I didn't believe it myself. And then I think over the last 3 months with sparring with Katie and getting the confidence from her, and even sparring with Kelly as well, it has lifted my confidence a lot. And this is actually the first competition I've come into really fully believing in myself that I could win a gold medal. And it's amazing what believing in yourself can do.
Brilliant. Amy Broadhurst on Morning Ireland with Mary Wilson. And on the Ryan Tuberty Show, slow motion running in the 1980s, the death of Vangelis, composer of some of the most iconic music in film history, was marked in the morning.
I'll tell you who did die is the guy who wrote one of the most amazing pieces of music from the movies, as we're in the movies again, that has been parodied, that when I was a kid and this movie was a big deal, the soundtrack was such a big deal that we used to pretend to be in the movie while singing the song in our heads to illustrate it. Because as soon as you hear this, you'll know what sport I'm referring to and the gag that goes with it. Now we're all slow motion running, trying to impress our friends. While singing. This is why we need the webcam here, because you would have been able to see my slow motion jogging here. Anyway, Vangelis dead, sadly. He was 79. Greek composer, Chariots of Fire, that being Chariots of Fire. But he also did another, as we're still in the movies this Friday morning. We're in Blade Runner country here. We're not some sordid nightclub in Soho. So Vangelis Papathanasio is no longer with us, at the Prime Minister of Greece. The world of music has lost the international artist Vangelis. He absorbed the tones of Greek folk songs and Orthodox Christian choral music, but he had no formal musical training, which he later said had helped save his sense of creativity. He reckoned that if he was well trained, they would have trained out the creativity out of his system. Interesting comment. He was attracted to all the electronic synthesizers, as per that last clip, and he was able to create his lush, melodic colours that became his trademark sound. A bit of prog rock success in the early 70s with Aphrodite's Child. Aphrodite's Child? Yes. You've seen the ads. Actually really like that. It reminds me of Le Fleur. It's good. Okay, Aphrodite's Child. And then he went to London, and that's where he wrote Chariots of Fire, which won the Oscar for him, which was about the group of British runners at the 1924 Olympic Games. And yeah, he said he wrote that partly in tribute to his father, who was a keen amateur runner.
From the Ryan Tuberty Show. And in the morning to boldly go.
Space, a final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its 5-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Yeah, I love it. The theme from Star Trek, and science educator Shane Bergen was talking about the technology of Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock. And Shane was very excited.
Good morning, Shane.
Good morning.
Bet you loved this one, did you?
I did. It brought me back to being a teenager. And the music you just played there is from the original show. And when I was a teenager, it was Captain Picard and The Next Generation that were on the go, and I loved it.
Yeah,
and
you're a super fan, I can tell.
I was, yeah, and I rediscovered it then during COVID, thanks to Netflix. I sat down and was watching them again. My wife doesn't hate them, which helps, but I'm sensing perhaps you're not a fan.
Look, I remember concert being on in our house. I wouldn't have been somebody who sat down in front of it. But I'm just thinking, if you went back and watched it now, are you not looking at them, you know, trying to communicate with each other on devices that are clearly made from Kellogg's cardboard boxes?
Absolutely. And when you look at the 1960s show, you see that a lot of the technology we have now is actually ahead of what they predicted. And it makes me think about what goes into good sci-fi, right? Should it be that the things seem futuristic but not completely beyond imagination? So you would take technology you have at that time and just try and imagine it 10, 20 years from now. So like some of that stuff is there. So like, for instance, communications. If you look at the early Star Trek, when they wanted to talk to each other, they took this thing out of their pocket, flipped it open and started talking. What does that sound like? You know, it wasn't until the 1970s that the world's first mobile phone was invented. So in 1966, this is completely futuristic.
They did well.
They did very well. And that trend continued. So you see in the next generation, they moved away from the smartphone, the kind of the gadget in their pocket, to a wearable device that you could talk to. Again, does that sound familiar? So if I say, Alexa, turn up the volume, I'm sure there's people running around the country now slamming the device to try and tell it to be quiet again, right? But we've become used to these things. So, in Star Trek The Next Generation, when I watched it in the 90s, it seemed completely futuristic to be able to just say...
They were talking into their watches, weren't
no,
they?
No, on their chests.
Oh, on their chests.
Yeah, it was on their chests. Yeah. Well, we talk into our watches. Mm-hmm. You know, so now you walk down the street and you could see somebody having a full conversation without holding a phone anywhere, and you think that's normal now, where like 15 years ago that would have been quite concerning, right?
And then when it comes to, I mentioned, you know, the cardboard cereal box, but they did have things that might look like iPads or
It was a pen and paper free world, and so they had clunky versions of iPads. They were all touchscreen, and that's how they did all of their reading and their writing. They had things that looked like laptops before laptops were invented. And for this day and age, they had Zoom. So like when they wanted to, like, you know, talk to a person back at base or on another ship, they would have teleconferencing. Of course, I never once in Star Trek saw anyone sort of, you know, become overwhelmed by the technology or have to tell like a Klingon on another ship they were on mute or anything like that. So I think what it shows is futurism, but also that everyone seems very sophisticated and capable with the technology. Whereas in reality, us humans here in the real world are far more
struggle.
Sort of.
Yeah. We struggle. Now, we have an example from the series Star Trek Voyager, and we have a clip of the character 7 of 9 explaining the food replicator.
This device. What does it do?
That's a standard food replicator.
Can it be used to create bioweapons?
Not unless you count Mr. Neelix's bouillon souffle. Let me show you. Computer, 1 slice of New York cheesecake. This is an old Earth delicacy.
That's just a vending machine, right?
It is, but it can magic up whatever you want, and it turns energy into matter. And 7 of 9 there ordered a cheesecake. Other fans might remember Captain Picard had ordered tea, and he'd, it would just appear. And it's like, wow, you know. Mm-hmm. And when you'd see that in the past, it was absolutely incredible. But it's not a million miles away from a 3D printer. And 3D printers now can produce really sophisticated things. I was reading about one this week that can print using 40 different materials, including metals. So it can replicate from a drawing. Now, it's not at the point yet where you could make your dinner from a replicator.
It doesn't do food, does it?
No, I wouldn't.
Such a pity.
I know. But
Shane Bergen from Today with Claire Byrne. And in the afternoon on the Ray Darcy Show, celebrating the 20-something anniversary of David Gray's White Ladder.
David Gray, good afternoon.
Hello there.
Good to see you.
Yes, it's nice to be here.
Yeah, so last night, the Three Arena finally got to do the White Ladder 20th anniversary tour gig. how was it?
It was quite amazing. It was breathtaking, really. I think that nothing stood still in the intervening years. And I think given the extra delay that the pandemic has enforced upon us, maybe the energy and anticipation and the need for a sort of musical release has grown exponentially in that short space of time. Whatever it was, it really just went off. It did just take my breath away at times.
So what sort of stuff? Obviously singing along was a part of it.
Singing along like I've hardly ever heard before. It was so loud, I don't think we could hear ourselves on stage at a couple of points. The Olays were out very early on. it was quite incredible, really. The Belfast show was amazing, the way it kicked off there. But last night it started a notch up and it ended up a notch higher.
Yeah.
It was quite mad.
And you have to do it again tonight and again tomorrow night.
It's awful. It's absolutely awful. Yeah.
All that adoration.
I have to enjoy myself.
And then you're back in Musgrave Park in Cork on the 18th of June. And there are tickets available for that, are there?
There are still tickets available for that. So come on, Cork. That could be a really big one as well. I'm very much looking forward to that. But first I'm just going to put one foot in front of the other and do these two shows. But please, if you'd like to come along, if you've missed out on this opportunity, there's always Cork.
Yeah. And was there a moment last night? Was there one particular moment?
I think that we do a kind of greatest hits set and that kind of warms the room up. And then we have a little interval and come back. And then, of course, the album's played in sequence. So you start with
lovely.
Please Forgive Me, Into Babylon. So it's a big start.
Yes.
And
finish with Say Hello, Wave Goodbye.
That's right. We do. Yes.
And, sorry.
So I think by the time we got to Babylon, that it was just so loud. I completely forgot what I was doing just for a moment. I couldn't believe, even just during the verse, not even the chorus.
Right.
And so I kind of came off the tracks for a moment there. And luckily, everyone else knew the words.
Yeah.
But a couple of times I was just open mouthed, just looking at the whole thing. Everybody on their feet, just going wild, really, and singing along, which is as it should be. I mean, I think for the thing to make sense to me, it has to be this kind of very personal connection that I've got with the crowd through the music. So I'm giving it to them, and they're giving me the whole thing back again. So it was quite a lot to take in.
And I've read the sleeve notes that you wrote for the 20th anniversary.
Yeah.
White Ladders, and it's very much about that, the audience owning it as well.
That's how I see it.
Yeah.
And I think once you've written a song, it's really quite incredible how it takes on a life of its own. And this record has just taken on a life of its own, and now I've sort of owned up to it, and I'm out there proving that point.
just on the stats, because did you record it in 1998 or 1997?
Yeah,
1998. So
I did.
So officially, it's next year would be the 25th anniversary.
I know. I mean, the numbers are becoming a bit confusing. So we've crossed it out on the t-shirts. The 2022 has gone over the 2020. It's all a bit mad like that. Yeah.
Oh yeah, I never thought about that, the merchandise.
Yeah, I just said cross it out and put 2022 on it. I'm not wasting all these shirts.
And it was recorded mainly, bar This Year's Love, in your house.
Yes, it was.
In London.
Yeah. And it's weird doing the songs as we are, which is exactly like they are on the record. So we've got all the sort of tech. I've got my old guitar out. Everything is just exactly as it was on the record. When I start to tread through the music in that way and sing exactly at the right tempo with the right sounds around me, it's weird. I'm sort of back in that room. A little part of me each night is back. With songs like Night Blindness and Silver Lining, I'm sort of transported back into that room.
Yeah.
It's weird. You just find yourself taking exactly the same path. Like there's a sort of a natural way for me to sing those songs. And when all the sounds are right, that's the way I want to go. So I sort of go back right to the beginning of not just the early gigs, but actually the making of the record. There's a strange time travel element to it.
Isn't that lovely? And I was reading as well that Babylon was recorded on a May Day, a lovely May Day.
It was.
When you'd finished it, and there was a couple of things you mentioned about it, that the traffic, the London traffic, you had to try and muffle that out. And then people had to stay quiet while watching you sing.
But then
at the end of it, you sort of knew there was something special about the song.
Well, I think what it was I think when you start making recordings, you're sort of emulating things that you've heard before to some extent. You're striving for your own voice and your own sound. And suddenly with that song, it felt, and Please Forgive Me before it, it felt like we were making a music that was ours. And that Babylon seemed to have an effect on other people straight away. I didn't have the objectivity to realise it had potential in a sort of commercial sense, but I was impressed by how enthralled I was by it as a soundscape and a thing. It wasn't like anything I'd done before, and yet it sort of had the main ingredients, my voice and guitar and everything, but it hadn't been diluted or compromised. It was just moving in it. So that it was that that I was convinced by. And if you want it, come and get it, crying out loud.
Love the hours. David Gray from the Ray Darcy Show. And on Today with Claire Byrne, after 2 years of restrictions, we're all ready for a bit of summer fun, but how much is it all going to cost?
Now, ticket prices for summer festivals and shows are set to rise because of soaring insurance premiums and rocketing costs. Event organisers have indicated customers are likely to be hit in the pocket, with entry fees increasing by up to €10 in some cases. The Alliance for Insurance Reform said tourism, hospitality, entertainment and leisure businesses that survived the pandemic are now being hit on average with a 16% increase in their insurance premiums. In a moment, we'll speak to the National Secretary of the Irish Shows Association, Jim Harrison. But first, Dennis Desmond is Managing Director of MCD and he joins me on the line. Good morning, Dennis. Thank you for joining us on the programme. You're seeing rising costs right across the board. Is that right?
Good morning, Sarah. Correct. We are seeing rising costs. But if I could just say, you will not see an increase in ticket prices this summer. So, in actual fact, the ticket prices from the majority of shows are already on sale, and a lot of them, the ticket prices are very much held 2019-2020 prices.
Okay, that's your policy at MCD, but perhaps other companies may not be able to cope and absorb the increase in costs that they're facing.
I think future shows, there will be an increase, and obviously I think you will see a slight increase in ticket prices for shows that are happening in 23. But the majority of events are already up and running for 22.
Okay, talk to me about the type of price increases that you're seeing and in what areas.
The increases basically are across the board. You obviously have the fuel increases that everybody's experiencing. But in addition to that, there is a shortage of labour. So you're looking at a lot of people did leave the business during the pandemic, found alternative employment. So as a result of that, there's a shortage of people. So you're having to hire new people, train them up. And in some cases, you know, the good thing is the people who are still in the industry, there's a big demand for their time, but there's a shortage of them and we're having to bring people in from Europe. So in a lot of instances, we're bringing in labour, flying in labour from Germany, Budapest, places like that. And the increased cost is the extra time involved in their flights, the hotels. And obviously, when there's a big demand, people charge a premium rate.
Yeah, and these are expert, experienced people, so you can't readily and quickly train them up here, even if you were to hire them.
Correct. Like huge demand for security, huge demand for riggers, electricians. And again, a lot of these people, when there was the uncertainty for the pandemic, they went and found alternative employment. A lot of them went into film industry. You've got a huge number of movies being made in Ireland, worldwide at the moment. Obviously, that industry is booming, which are Netflix, Amazon, etc. So, yeah, big demand for skilled labour. The entertainment, hospitality industry, we've been at a standstill for 2 years. We're back. We're busier than ever. And obviously, there's a big demand for labour.
Dennis Desmond of MCD from Today with Claire Byrne. Friday, it brings out the fun on the Ryan Tuberty Show. Have a listen to Claire Kelly and her tale of Rashers the Macro Micro Pig.
Claire Kelly, good morning.
Good morning, Ryan. How are you?
I'm fine. I was talking to Elise O'Byrne White yesterday from the TV show The Shelter, Animal SOS, and we were talking about pets. And she said, "Be careful if you're going to get a duck to be your pet, don't bring him in and start feeding him a sliced pan. You know, that kind of thing."
Exactly.
This brought you to our attention because your sister-in-law had long wanted a particular pet.
Yes, she wanted a micro pig.
What does that mean?
Well, it's a breed of pig that is really not supposed to grow much beyond the size of a medium-sized dog, kind of a collie kind of thing.
Is it a pot-bellied pig? Is it the same thing, a micro pig?
Yes, yeah, it would be, Ryan. It would be, yes, yeah.
Okay, why did she want such a thing? I'm just curious. I don't mean to be pejorative or anything, but just as a matter of interest.
Animal Mad just had taken a fancy to the notion that she wanted this particular creature.
I know, but like Animal Mad, get a dog. Animal Mad, have a goldfish. Animal Mad, it's a budgie. Animal Mad, pig.
I know. Well, sure, look, I suppose there's no accounting for other people's taste, is there?
No, but I kind of like her style. I like that she went offbeat. Yeah. That's what I like about her. Okay, so she wanted this micro pig, grows the size of a dog, small dog, and your husband is being a good big brother, said, okay, what you want, you know, as you wish.
I shall get.
Okay, so what did he do?
So he went off and, being a good diligent guy that he is, he had done his research, so he thought, and had located a person who was breeding these micro pigs.
Great.
And so for a present, I think it was a birthday, it could have been Christmas, but I think it was her birthday, he went off and he bought her this pig and came home and presented this beautiful creature to his sister, who duly named the pig Rashers.
Well, now that's not very nice. Is it? That's like naming a human corpse.
Exactly. Exactly.
So they named Rashers the pig. Where do you keep such an animal? Do they live in a farm or?
No. My father-in-law was the local postmaster and shopkeeper in Rosslare village. And so the pig was being kept in a pen in the back garden.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
And was Rashers happy as a pig in a shop? Like, was he a happy pig?
Yes, apparently so.
Clean?
He was, yes, and happy and person-friendly and very well-behaved initially when he was small.
Well, he was always going to be small because he's a micro-pig.
Well, that's what they thought, Ryan.
Go on.
Rashers started to grow.
Uh-oh.
And he grew.
Uh-oh.
And he grew.
Uh-huh.
And he grew a bit more.
Crikey, okay.
Until it became apparent that he wasn't a micro pig, but he was a great big boar or a hog. I don't know what female. I don't know. Couldn't tell you what that's
called. We all know one of them anyway. But
yes, exactly, yes.
This big boar or hog, as you say, this big pig, full life size, is now living in this pen in the back garden of the shop?
Yes.
Right.
And my mother-in-law didn't have a stick of grass or anything left, so there was a bit of consternation going on here.
Did he go full Steve McQueen? Did he escape to victory at some point?
Oh, the great escape occurred. So
the great escape.
He decided that he was going to take a little bit of a wander. He wanted to see beyond the confines of the shop garden.
Naturally.
So, well, of course, curiosity. Yeah. Didn't kill the pig, it killed the cat. So he decided away.
Yeah, me too. Good woman, Claire. Go on. Oh, you're ahead of me. I love that. Go on.
Oh, dear. But off he went and he took a rampage through the garden fence, through the neighbour's garden, ate a good few of the neighbour's vegetables on the way through, and decided that he was going to take a little visit up the village of Rosslare.
I'm trying to visualise this enormous pig going, I'm done with this pen, I'm going up to the town. And I'll just like, a neighbour's garden, humph, I'll have a bit of that, up to town, humph, ice creams, humph. Just eating and just kind of like a swaggering drunk after closing time.
Yes, absolutely.
Now,
and off he went. And, and of course, you know, Rosslare, you've got Kelly's Resort, so this didn't go down very locals.
Lock up your children. Here comes the pig.
Exactly. Here comes Rashers the pig.
Rashers. So what did he do for his time? How long was he gone for? What did he get up to?
I'm not sure exactly, but I know that my father-in-law was behind the shop counter and a slightly irate neighbour popped in to say, Mr. Lambert, do you know that your pig is in the middle of the village causing a bit of a furore?
Mm-hmm.
So, Julie, my father-in-law, called the troops in. So my husband, his sister and their brother were sent up the village to hunt this pig back down the house home.
Okay.
So I've got this mental image of the three of them waving their hands madly, chasing this pig back down the middle of the village.
We're going on a pig hunt. And
exactly.
They got him. I mean, what was he? Didn't stop off for a cocktail at a local bar or, you know.
Well, I'm sure he tried, but
he just sounds like he's got,
they encouraged him.
So they got him back.
Yes.
And family conference then, what to do with rashers or just put them back in the pen or what do you do?
So mother-in-law Teresa said, no, this cannot happen again. This is his last great adventure. So Rashers was retired to a local pet farm.
Oh, no.
Where the but he was a pet farm. He got to meet lots of... I thought it was farm, but I asked my husband last night and he informed me it was a pet farm.
Oh.
And he was apparently king of the castle and lived there happily until he died. So... and he didn't become Rashers. That's a very important thing to say. He never became Rashers.
Yeah, that's what you were told. And when did you get details of where the pet farm was?
No,
isn't that
he never
funny?
Said. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah.
You wouldn't hit him up for a few details there, no?
No, he wasn't very forthcoming about that. He just
isn't
said,
that funny?
Pet farm.
You don't worry, Claire. Rashers has gone to the pet farm.
Ah, Ryan, poor Rashers at the pet farm. And in the afternoon, on the live line with Katie Hannan, liberating the lobster.
And now, many of you may have seen a video that was put on, up online recently of a group of animal rights activists who were liberating, I think that's the word they would use, liberating lobsters from a lobster tank in a city centre restaurant in Dublin. This is something that has happened sporadically around the world in the last number of years. And of course, a big row out there in the animal rights world about whether or not lobsters feel pain. How much pain do they feel? Is it cruel to boil them alive? Are people still boiling them alive? Anne, good afternoon to you.
Hello there. How are you, Katie?
Where do you stand on the lobster question, Anne?
Yes, well, what happened was a year or so ago, I made friends with a man who said he was a Buddhist, but he worked in a restaurant and he said he boiled lobsters. And I questioned that and he said that it was because they're a smaller animal and therefore it doesn't count as much. I thought at the time, well, if you're going to kill an animal, kill a big one like a cow, because then you can feed loads of other people. But it was funny that I broke up my friendship with him, and then a few days later it came out in the news that in the UK they had banned, they're going to be banning painful ways of killing lobsters, including possibly burning alive. And I thought it was like kind of karmic that I had kind of broken my friendship with the Buddhist for that reason. And I thought, well, if it can happen in England, why can't it happen in Ireland? Now, I had been campaigning. In fact, I often had to stand with a picture of a lobster outside a restaurant because I didn't do the active entering like some of the other activists in England when I lived there. And I was very happy to see that it has helped. Like anyone who contributes has helped. Now, I'm not saying this is going to change the killing of lobsters, but according to what I understand, there have been research done by the London School of Economics with the Royal Veterinary College just to verify what we would usually believe anyway, which is that even if the lobsters and other crustaceans, like in Ireland, we fish for brown crab, velvet crab and spider crab, they still have feelings even they don't have a spinal cord. They're... the external shell is their protection and they're kind of like their back, their spinal cord, bone to keep them, you know, to keep them like we have our back. And they only let that's why their flesh is so tender. They only let themselves out of their shells when they're molting or mating. Now, again, it's not just about the giving a more humane way of treatment, but we also have to look at the side of what are we getting out of this now. Crabs and what I was very surprised to find out at the time, and now I know more about, is that crabs, brown crabs and lobsters can live up to, well, brown crabs can live up to 100, but the average lifespan in the wild would be maybe even 50 years. And they have a very slow gestation and reproduction. So when you fish for them, obviously there are rules. They have to be over a certain size. But you could be actually stopping them, like lobsters. They can produce 40,000 spawn. You're actually stopping a lot of more of the lobsters or the crabs coming back into the pool.
And Katie asked Anne if she ever tried to rescue a crustacean.
Yes, that was a bit of a failure, but that was like 25 or 30 years ago. I'm quite old, you know. And I was working in a law firm in London as a temp, unfortunately. And I went to the local market and there was some crabs, and I took three of them and I hid them in the bathroom in a bucket. And what I didn't know at the time was that everyone was wondering whose crabs these belonged to. What I didn't know at the time was that you couldn't cover them in plain non-salted water. So then I did the 2.5 hour journey by train to the nearest town that had a sea. And by the time I got there, to be honest, I think they're 90% sure that at least two of them were dead.
So you murdered those crabs then?
Well, the next time I found a crab, I actually went into Tesco's and bought some crabs. And I was going to go all the way to the local sea. That was about 5 or 6 years ago. But I saw I asked some people who were getting on the train. I said, can you carry these dry crabs and release them into the sea?
You stopped random people and asked random them to take people. Your
well,
crabs
it was,
and liberate
it like
them.
Like 50 or 60 pounds to go there. So
so you've made a number of attempts to rescue crustaceans over the years.
Well, the last time I did it, I went to, I think it was Southend, and all there was, like, saw so many people, a lot of foreigners going out because the tide was out, just picking mussels and crabs. And I thought, well, there's no chance. They'll just be brought back to the table, which is why I think it'd be better to just change, like, just if people are aware that, first of all, it's causing pain. Two, crabs and lobsters can live very, very long lives. In fact, they, considering what we live on the HSC, they're probably much more long lives than we do without any medical treatment.
And Paul was listening to Anne and he called in.
I disagree pretty much with what Anna's saying. I do agree on one item she's brought up about overfishing of fish and lobsters and shellfish and so on. I have two uncles who fished for lobster all their lives. They would also catch brown crab as well, which is not, they don't intentionally fish for it. That's the kind of an accident. That just ends up in the pots. Yes. I've seen them cook them. The emotive language that's being used, for example, being boiled alive, I think that's slightly emotive. What I've seen them do is a pot of boiling water, the lobster is dropped into it. It flaps for maybe 2 seconds, maybe three. And that's it. Now, that's the lobster killed.
That's being boiled alive, Paul. How else would you describe that as except being boiled alive?
Okay. All right. You can. Okay. It is being boiled and it is alive. But how long that lasts for is the point. It's 2 to 3 seconds. Now, I work in the marine industry, not in anything to do with fishing, but because of where I work, I'm down around harbours, marinas and so on all the time. Yeah. As a regular occurrence, pretty much every day you see this. A large seagull, a herring gull or a blackback gull gets an unfortunate crab who came up the weed a bit too far, gets hold of it, takes it onto the marina, turns it over and opens up the shell and starts eating it. He's in no hurry.
So it's being eaten alive. It's being eaten alive, literally.
The crab is quite literally. I've watched them do it. It lasts for maybe 3 or 4 or 5 minutes. The crab is still moving. It's still trying to get. It's not going to get away. It's upside down. But this is being eaten alive.
But that's, now, but that's nature,
crab,
Paul. Paul, that's
one
nature.
Moment, if I was a crab or a lobster and I had the option of being dropped in boiling water for 2 to 3 seconds or eaten alive, I don't think I'd be going with option two.
That's Paul on the live line with Katie Hannon. And on today with Claire Byrne, the importance of weightlifting and resistance training and where to begin.
Weight training can help keep your metabolism healthy, meaning you'll burn more calories even when you're resting. And the benefits of this kind of resistance training aren't just for young people. Professor Roseanne Kenny recently told us on the programme how at any age, weights can be one of the best things you can do for your health. So here to talk us through what you need to know for how to get started with weights, we have Jenny Brannigan, Chartered Physiotherapist at Total Physio in Sandyford, and Niall Moyne, Professor of Clinical Exercise Physiology at the School of Health and Human Performance at DCU. Thank you both for joining us. You're very welcome. Niall, I know you're a big proponent of the weights as well. Why is it so important, resistance training?
Well, I think you alluded to it already. It's the issue. Muscle is around 40% of our total body weight, and people think it's only...
It should be.
Well, it should be, yeah. That's a very good point. And, you know, people think it's only for locomotion. It's hugely important also for metabolism. And roughly at the age of 30, we start to lose muscle mass. Now, you can maintain muscle mass up to the age of 50, same muscle mass you had when you were 15. But we tend to lose it. A large part of the reason we tend to lose it is because we become inactive and we lose that muscle. And what eventually happens, people don't realise in their 30s and 40s, and not only you get metabolic changes in the muscle, and all of a sudden you reach 65 and 70 years of age, you have this excess fat, and now you're finding it difficult to do activities of daily living. We call that sarcopenia, which means muscle wasting. And that's a vicious, vicious cycle. A simple example is, if you're between the ages of 20 and 60, and you lie in bed for a week, your muscles will age 1 year. Mm. If you're over the age of 60, and you lie in bed for a week, your muscles will age a decade.
Right, so you've terrified us all. Is it ever too late, though, to start?
And that's the point. You can reverse. Like, you might lose between the ages of 20 and 60, you probably will lose around 25%, 30% of your muscle mass on average. Mm-hmm. You can regain all of that within a year of starting resistance. The muscle, even at 100 years of age, the muscle is extremely pliable, extremely adaptable. So at any time, you can get the benefits.
Yeah, it can be very daunting for people, Jenny, which is why we're having this conversation, because you think about resistance training and weights, you think about going into the gym and pumping iron. You don't need to go that far. In fact, you would say, please don't go that far when you're starting out.
No, absolutely. And that is one of the big barriers. People are a bit intimidated by it sometimes. They think, I don't own dumbbells. I don't want to go into a gym. They have pictures of, you know, huge, big, buffed up, burly guys. And they think, I can't be standing beside somebody like that. So they don't ever think about doing it. But what we talk about is, we talk about technique being the most important thing. So it doesn't matter about the weight initially. We start people off and we make sure that their form is good. We look at how they move initially. There's no point thinking about weights if you have somebody who cannot squat easily in and out of a chair without using their hands to push out the chair. If they cannot lunge easily without their whole body sort of collapsing forward, we need to make sure that their basic movement is good first. And then as they get better at those basic movements, then we start to load them with smaller weights. And again, how we decide what's an appropriate weight is really important. You might lift something heavy once and be able to manage that, but can you lift that same weight 12 or 15 times? So we look at what you can do for 12 or 15 repetitions, and those last two or three repetitions must be difficult enough that the last one is one where you think, oh, I couldn't lift anything more. And that's an appropriate weight for you to start at. So if you're 30, you will be able to start at a higher weight than somebody who's maybe 60 and they haven't lifted weights at all. But we would start that process with them, looking at their basic movement technique first. Form is always the most important. And then we find the suitable weight for them and we build up from there.
Mm-hmm. And Noel, what would you say to people who are listening to this now who maybe think, well, I thought I was grand going for a good walk every day. I need to start doing this now. Where do they start? Where do they begin?
Yeah, and that's a very good point, because, you know, there are four components of what we call health-related fitness. They're ideal body weight, body composition, flexibility and balance, cardiovascular endurance, and then the fourth one is muscular strength and endurance. And a lot of people, they tend to think, if I'm doing cardio, I'm fine. Now, that is weight-bearing. If you're doing weight-bearing exercise, that is good for your muscle and your bone. But the best way to maintain muscle and increase muscle is to put resistance, is to overload the muscle, have it do something harder than it's normally used to doing. So there are lots, I believe, and Jenny hit the nail on the head, self-efficacy, or their ability to believe that they can do it, is the biggest problem. And particularly among females, they just think, oh, I can't walk into a gym, I wouldn't even know, don't even know the name of the weight. But my advice is, go and talk to a musculoskeletal specialist, someone like a physiotherapist, if you have some issues in relation to your bones or your muscles. If not, then contact a personal trainer or go into a gym, particularly in the off-peak hours. You can go into a gym and not be a member, say around 9:30 to 11 o'clock in the morning, and say, look, I'm interested in joining a gym, or I'm thinking about starting a resistance program. Can you talk me through? And normally what they would do is they would take you on to the machines. So when you're doing machines, it's very difficult to be incorrect when you're doing machines. The machine does all the work. You just sit there and you do it. And then once you progress from that, I should even state actually even before that, a lot of people can do weights, can do all this at home with no weights.
Niall Moynagh and Jenny Branigan from Today with Claire Byrne. And on Morning Ireland, the Freedom of Galway was being awarded to Patricia Burke Brogan and Aina McEntee, to women who worked to help other women escape the Magdalen laundries in the 1960s. Here's Mary Wilson.
Thousands of girls and women were locked up in Magdalen laundries in Ireland and their identities taken, stripped of their dignity, simply for being an unmarried mother or considered morally wayward in a judgmental country. Society in the main turned a blind eye, but not everyone chose to ignore what was happening in plain sight. And today, two women, Patricia Burke Brogan and posthumously Aina McEntee, will be awarded the Freedom of Galway. Both women worked to protect and assist residents of the former Magdalen Laundry in Galway in the 1960s. We can talk now to Andy McEntee, son of Aina McEntee, who coordinated the escape of 15 women from the laundry back in the 1960s. Andy, thank you for joining us.
Good morning, my pleasure.
Your mother worked in the laundry, so she witnessed firsthand how the women were treated. Will you tell us what you remember about the Great Escape?
I can indeed. We would have been 9 to 10. I would have been 9 to 10. My brothers would be a little bit younger than I at the time. And we got to meet the girls ourselves through the fact that we used to walk home past the laundry in the evenings. And in the odd day, the gate would be open and we'd go in. And although the windows were barred, my mum used to walk inside one of those windows. And she had a 5 or 6 ladies with her from time to time doing the various jobs that they did in there. And over a period of time, we got to know them just as well. But at home in the evenings, we'd often discuss it. And we had noticed ourselves where some of the ladies would have marks on them or would not be right, could be upset certain days and stuff like that. And it transpired that they were being abused in there by the nuns. And my mum took this very seriously and very personally because she had become very friendly with them. And over another period of time, we decided that maybe, you know, we might be able to do something to help. And that's when we mooted the Great Escape, so to speak.
So the whole family was kind of involved in planning
it. Yes. My dad, my mum, and my two brothers, Hugo, Declan, and I.
So 15 women. How did you coordinate from your mother to you all?
Okay.
And the getaway?
Well, the initial one, which would have been the scariest, was of a winter's evening where it was dark and wet. And we had arranged for 4 of the ladies to be let out through the back door by our mum, who had acquired the key, which she returned later on, and it hadn't been missed, so the nuns suspected nothing. I was at the outside gate, and I escorted the ladies to a walkway up beside the local church, where Hugo was waiting for them, and he brought them up the walkway to another street in Prospect Hill in Galway, where Dad was waiting in the van, and Declan there was waiting to open the door and get them into the van quick and off up past the laundry and out to Merview, which is where we lived. And we brought them into the house and they were there for something like 6 weeks while we organised through friends of theirs or friends of ours to get them various jobs or get them out of the country and stuff like that. Bearing in mind, we still thought that they were all escapees, that there were prisoners, that we were in trouble if we were caught. We didn't realise at the time, as did anybody else, that the girlies were there, just locked up, basically. Yeah,
they had done nothing
wrong. Nothing wrong whatsoever.
And Andy, that happened again and again. And eventually, did the nuns rumble what your mother was doing?
Yes, we did 4 trips over a period. 3 fours and a 3, 15 ladies in all. And the nuns, no time let on inside in the laundry that anything was amiss, that any of the girls had gone or anything. They never let on at all. Even though we do know that the Gardaí were dispatched to the local train station, the bus station, to keep an eye to see if any of them getting the bus to escape from the city. But that was not to be the case, because when we did helped them to leave the city, my dad was smart enough to bring them to one of the other stations outside of the city and put them on the train there and give them a few bob to get on their way.
Your mother was a great woman. She was a brave woman.
She was indeed. She eventually got a letter in the post with her wages in it and a very brief note from the nuns that her services were no longer required.
Andy McEntee speaking about his late mother, Aina, who, along with Patricia Burke Brogan, was awarded the Freedom of Galway for Morning Ireland. And on the Ryan Tuberty Show, after a morning of Rashers the Macro Pig, Colette Cole went one up with her story of Rover the Robot Lawnmower.
I want to stay in the garden now and talk to somebody else who's referring to our show yesterday when I was talking about the robotic lawnmowers. Couldn't believe that such a thing are existing and are actually happening, but they are. Good morning, Colette.
Good morning, Ryan. Hi, how are you?
It's lovely to talk to you this morning, and I believe you have one of these robot lawnmowers.
I do. He came to look after the grass just over 2 years ago now, and has made a huge difference to how the grass looks, and has given me lots of nice free time.
In what way, Colette? How?
How? Well. Will I tell you his name? He's called Rover.
You've named the robot?
I've named the robot. So he's a bit of a personality.
Okay.
So he's programmed to cut the grass every day. He could be programmed to cut it once a week or twice a week, but I've quite a big garden and it takes him a while to get around. So he gets going every evening around 8 o'clock and he works until 12. He might go back for a charge or two in that time to the battery, and he cuts the grass. The grass stays on the grass that's there and feeds it.
Okay. I'm so confused. And you're telling this story so perfectly well and clearly, but my mind, you know, I've got nearly a robot, like Metal Mickey, you know, holding on to a lawnmower, pushing it up and down in lines. But can you describe what this thing looks like? Could I get a picture of it?
Okay,
maybe?
I think I sent you a picture with my email.
Oh, yeah, I'll have a look at that. Yeah,
have a look. Like a little car.
Oh. And you leave it at the corner of the garden and then it just starts up?
It has a little parking bay, okay, which has a power point to it to charge him when he needs the battery charged. So what else can I tell you about him? Okay, so he has a menu. And you put on the menu what time you would like him to cut the grass at. So if there are visitors coming, going to be grandkids out in the garden, Rover isn't going to be working. So he's programmed to work when...
Yeah, when you want him to.
When
really.
I want him to.
How are you with technology? I can't imagine I'd be any... I don't have any grass anyway, so it's not an issue for me. But
I'm not too bad. Yeah, I'm good. The other thing is I have two dogs.
Tell me.
And they've gotten used to him. They ignore him.
They're all friends, all fair and love, love and more.
All that.
What are your dogs' names?
Tashi and Bibi.
And their breeds?
Their breed is Shih Tzu.
Shih Tzu, as they used to laugh about that, a zoo with no animals.
I know.
And you know the gags. And
I do.
Tell me this, are your dogs, did you win a big award with one of those dogs?
I did indeed, yeah.
Tell me.
I did. Back in 2014, Ryan, we had qualified to go to Crofts with Tashi, which is very exciting in itself.
Yeah.
Just going and great fun, and a big Irish contingent go to Crofts every year and show their dogs and have a good old time.
And how did Tashi do?
Well, she won Best of Breed.
Well, congratulations. I'm sorry, Colette. I didn't realise I was dealing with such canine class here. This is a remarkable development.
Colette Cole, owner of prize-winning dogs and Rover the Robot, from The Ryan Tuberty Show. And that's it for Playback Dailies. So mind yourself. Till next time.